So there are some new faces here, which is great. What we did last time is we introduced the Masechta. This Masechta we chose to learn is called Maseches Kedushin, and it does talk about a number of topics. The beginning topic does talk about marriage, and in basic, there are, just to review for a minute, there are two stages of every Jewish marriage. There's the first stage of marriage, which is called Kedushin, which has a Hebrew synonym called Erusin. And the best English word that we have for it is betrothal. It's not engagement, but it's the first stage of marriage where an act of acquisition has to happen. It's almost like we treat it seriously enough that something significant, a kinyan, an act of acquisition, must take place. After the first stage of marriage, the woman is considered to be married and that she is prohibited to everyone else in the world. But she's still also prohibited to her husband. She's not yet permitted to be intimate with her husband until they go through the second stage of marriage. And the second stage of marriage is called Nisuin. And there are a number of ways to accomplish that. It used to be in times of old, those two things were separated perhaps by even up to a year. Nowadays, we do both underneath the chuppah. We do both the first stage of marriage and the second stage of marriage. And what we did last time is we began reading the Mishnah. And we mentioned, and we'll just review for those who weren't here, Ha'isha, the beginning and the top of the Mishnah, and Daf Beis Amud Aleph, right there in the box, Ha'isha niknes b'shalosh darachim, that a woman is acquired, meaning you enter into the first stage of marriage in one of three ways, v'kona es atzma, and she'll acquire her own independence, meaning leaving the marriage to now be available to go and marry somebody else, b'shtei darachim, in two ways. And the Mishnah first lists, Niknes b'kesef b'shtaru b'biyah. She could be acquired through either extending to her kesef, which is money, shtar, a document upon which or where it's written, the statement that you are hereby going to be betrothed to me, or b'biyah, you could actually use marital relations to effect this first stage of marriage. And where we kind of left off last time is we were in the middle, we had read a Rashi. The Rashi, which is on the inside of the page, Rashi on this side. So Rashi, four lines down, Bekesuf uvishtar, Rashi had told us, he went, even though the Gemara is going to, at times, in depth, tell us what are the three mechanisms, Rashi provided a little bit of insight, and I wanted to begin tonight by extending one of those thoughts. So Rashi says, Mefarish b'braisa b'gemara, it's going to be explained later on in the Gemara, Nosin la kesef o shava kesef, that you could either extend to her, you give to her silver, let's translate it literally, o shava kesef, something worth silver, money or the worth of money, something that has worth. V'omer la, and you make a verbal declaration when you give it to her by saying, Hareyat mikudeshasli, you are hereby betrothed to me. Shtar kosev la al haniyar. Shtar is you'll write her on a piece of paper. Afal pi sheino shava pruta. Even though the piece of paper in and of itself is not worth a shava pruta, you're going to write on it, Hareyat mikudeshasli, you are hereby betrothed to me, and you're going to extend her the piece of paper. So this point I wanted to just go and embellish a little bit more. Why, when Rashi tells us that the piece of paper that you're giving her is not worth a shava pruta, so it's not worth any, it doesn't have any value. You buy a stack in Staples of 500 sheets of paper, one piece of paper most probably does not have any value. But there are pieces of paper in the world that do have value. You could have an expensive manuscript, and for whatever reason you decided to deface the manuscript and write on it to your beloved, you are hereby betrothed to me. So then the piece of paper does have some value. So what happens in a situation where you would extend to her the kiddushin, you would extend to her and try to enter into the first stage of marriage with a piece of paper that is of value, and then it turns out that the piece of paper was the shtar, the document that you tried to write, was a false document. There are a number of ways that you can ruin a document. The same way, you know, in the olden days when they type with typewriters, you could, you know, you make a little move and you ruin the whole page. There are mechanisms there or ways that you can mess up a Jewish document. One of the ways is if you didn't have in mind when you were writing the document and you wrote the name, you know, let's say you wrote your name and you wrote the girl's name, and you didn't have in mind that it was actually you and that it was actually the girl. It was what's called shalo lishma, without intent. The document won't be a good document. So here's the question. If I wrote a document, and on the document, and the piece of paper was a worthwhile piece of paper. It had value to it. And I wrote, "You are hereby betrothed to me." And I extend the document to the Isha, to the woman, and it turns out that the document is not a good document. But I did give her something of value. So is there a plan B? The fact that there's one way to get married by giving her something of value. We use a ring. You could use a fancy piece of paper. You could use a pen. It's not so romantic, but you could say Hariat Mikudesh Pen Zu, Kedas Moshe Yisrael. It might not go, Shever Brachos might not be so smooth, but you could do it. So the question is, when you extend to her something of value that you were trying to get married through a shtar, does it work if the shtar, if the very document had value? So take a look at source number one on the sheets that we have. So the commentary of the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim of Gerona, who was one of the Rishonim who lived in the 1300s in Spain, he writes as follows, Od Nira Li, in source number one on the sheet, Od Nira Li, it further appears to me, Shekosvu Lelamed Lemekadesh Bishtar, that we could actually learn out to the person who's trying to enter that first stage of marriage that we call Kiddushin through a document. Uposel Midin Shtar. And then, according to the rules and regulations of said document, it's deemed to be nullified. One example is that the document was written without proper intent. If the piece of paper was worth at least a pruta, had some monetary value, mahani bidin kesef. It would then count as him extending the kiddushin to her through kesef. The kiddushe shtar, the siunami anir. The fact that you're doing it on a shtar, it means it's on a piece of paper, and the piece of paper has value. The Ran is citing from the Rif, who cites from a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and they're understanding that by you extending to her something of value, even though you messed up your original goal, it's still effective. So that's one side of the machlokas, one side of the argument.
You must hold Yesh Brera, right?
In which place?
Brera, if I turn to...
That
your actions show what your intentions were.
I think it might be a question. The other school of thought is held by one of the Rishonim, the Meiri, and a very early an Achron who lived in the mid 1700s, who wrote a sefer called the Sefer HaMakna. Sefer HaMakna on Maseches Kiddushin. The Sefer HaMakna was written by Rav Pinchas HaLevi Horowitz. He was the brother of the famous Hasidic rabbi, Rav Shmuel Shmeltam in Nikolsburg. So this Rav Pinchas HaLevi, so he's very famous because he became the rabbi in Frankfurt. Frankfurt was one of the biggest cities in Germany. So how did he get the job in Frankfurt? So it's a story that maybe some people here know, maybe some people don't. There was a case in the 1700s. There was a very sensitive divorce case that was debated by almost every rabbi who lived in Europe at the time, and it was called a Jewish divorce document that came from that was taking place in the city of Cleves, the Get Me Cleves, the Get from Cleves. And literally all the Rabbanim in Europe sided on one side of the debate, whether the get was a good get, not a good get. There was the mental status of one of the parties involved, one of the spouses was in question. And the question was it a good get or not a good get? And this, Rav Pinchas, he's also known as the Hafla. The other sefer that he wrote is the Hafla. So he was about to write a whole responsa, a whole answer, how the get was a good get. Was a good get. And what happened was, when he finished writing the whole responsa, he spilled the inkwell on top of the page, and it was totally ruined. And his students turned to him and said, "Rebbe, it must be some sign that you shouldn't write this. So many rabbis have already written about this. You don't bother yourself. Don't write another one." So he listened to his students, and years later, when Rav Avram Abish, who was the Rav in Frankfurt, died, he was one of the leading ones against this divorce document. He held the divorce was not valid. And his congregation had so much respect for him, they said, "We're only going to hire a rabbi who was not who was not pro this get. And so the person who we're about to hear about, the Rav Pinchas, was able to apply for the job, and he went ahead and he got the job, and he was the Rav in Frankfurt. So the Meiri and the Sefer HaMakna, they both hold that no, this individual who decided to write a document and use the mechanism of writing a document to affect Kiddushin, the fact that it failed. It totally messed up. And the fact that it's worth something, the fact that the paper is not a piece of paper from Staples, but it's a nice piece of parchment that you had to buy for, you know, I don't know what. I don't know what parchment goes for, but, you know, a nice... Anybody? No sofa from here. Well, you know, there are things that are expensive. You know, you took the Declaration of Independence and you wrote on the back of it. You know, it's something, and so it has value. The Meiri and the Sefer HaMakna say it doesn't matter. You decided to go ahead and affect this Kiddushin through means of writing, and it didn't work. So you have to go back. You have to go back to and re-engage and decide which way you're going to go. You're going to extend Kesef. You're going to extend Shtar, or you're going to extend Bia.
Did you still acquire it?
The piece of paper?
Yeah, it's worth something. Is it hers?
Presumably it is hers, but it's not. Doesn't affect the Kiddushin. So here's the question. And this machlokas might actually be really fundamental within the laws of acquiring almost, maybe even anything and any business acquisition in this regard. And this Rafi's thought might play. The question is, when you decide that you want to acquire something, what is the focus? Is the focus on the goal or the means that will lead you to the goal? So according to what the Ran was saying, the Ran and the Rif were saying that it's about the goal. The goal is to marry the woman. I have to be kona her somehow. So even though I tried going with mechanism A, which was a shtar, and it didn't work out, the fact of the matter is my goal is what's the focus. And so a plan B could work. The other side might say no. When you are trying to acquire something, It's all about your initial intention. And if your initial intention was to go at a route of using a document and that blew up in your face, you're stuck. Your original, and maybe this was Rav saying, we go back and say your original intention just blew up. If your original intention blew up, it doesn't make a difference that you have a goal. The road to get you to the goal just got destroyed. And so you'd have to go back and you'd have to go ahead and do another act of kinyan in order to affect the marriage.
So according to that, and the third method, which is sexual relations, you had to have intent to...
Correct.
Rather than just having...
Correct. Correct. And that it happened in the end of the day. In the end of the day, the Gemara outlawed affecting marriage that way because it's considered to be promiscuous. It's not considered to be, you know, the way a nice Jewish boy and girl should go about affecting their marriage. But you're right. You can't... We mentioned a little bit last time that you're going to have to even there's even going to have to be witnesses involved. And the question is, how could witnesses be involved? And the most popular way is that they would have to stand outside the door, watch a man and a woman go into a secluded room, and that would affect it. But it has to be with the intent. It can't just necessarily be with the intent of a one night stand, something like that. So this machlokas might actually have greater ramifications, and that's why. That's why I wanted to share it.
Briefly, interrupt you.
Yeah.
So if the paper itself is, you know, Staples, one sheet of paper.
Right.
Right. Is there a minimum of what would be, basically that's the ketubah, right?
No.
That's not the ketubah.
Not the ketubah. The document that we're talking about here,
right?
I don't believe anyone at this table made use of, including myself.
This is separate.
This is another way to go through to the betrothal. The ketubah document, which is crucially important, plays a role in the second stage of marriage. The ketubah document doesn't say that we're going to be betrothed, but it lays out the financial obligations that the husband has to his wife, some that mention about during the marriage, and also if the marriage were to dissolve, which we're going to talk about, the two ways that any marriage can dissolve, the finances that would go towards the woman, that's what the ketubah talks about. And we don't, the second stage of marriage, we don't allow a husband and wife to be intimate together until she has the ketubah. And it even plays, and this you could ask every shul rabbi, I'm sure Rabbi Fink has dealt with it, you might even deal with it once a year. If you don't know where your ksuba is, then you can't even be alone in a house together with your wife. And you have to go ahead and write, it's not a big deal, you can write another ksuba, it's called a ksuba de irkasa. But you need always that ksuba needs to be there in order, it's the financial security, which is also at the foundation of the ability for them to have a healthy marriage.
Why do you need this first stage? Why, especially because you say we do both stages at once on the.
So that's our practice. But the first stage is considered to be a mitzvah. The way that we get married is considered to be a mitzvah, just like the way we put on a mezuzah is a mitzvah, and that we mentioned it last week. We'll actually mention it again tonight. The Rambam gave us a little bit of a history lesson that before the Torah was given, if you want to get married, you know, Harry meets Sally, just find a girl. If you're both consenting, go take her to your home, close the door, beino levein atzmo, by yourself, nobody needs to watch anything, no one, no witnesses, no nothing, and you're married. Once the Torah was given, the Jewish nation, the Jews, were given a mitzvah to get married in a certain way. So when you want to get married, you have to follow this approach, just like when you want to celebrate Pesach, you have to celebrate it. You know, you have to eat matzah. So when you want to get married, you have to do this.
So to answer your question, could you say that it's like an engagement in modern day?
See, the reason why you can't say that it's an engagement is because when anybody here at the table got engaged, halachically, not much happened. When, you know, if you drop down on one knee, if you didn't, if you put it on the big screen in Shea Stadium,
for many times, many people.
But it's for usually there are no witnesses, and you're not having it. When you ask the question, "Will you marry me?" So it's, "Will you marry me?" So for some people, it's, "Will you marry me?" When we set our wedding date a year from now, a year and a half from now, if you're a little more religious, 3 months from now, 6 weeks from now, whatever it may be. But "Will you marry me?" is not affect. No one has in mind to affect marriage. And she clearly, the girl definitely doesn't have a mind to affect marriage. I mean, you know, how could you get married in the middle of the parking lot or wherever you're in the middle of the fancy restaurant? I don't have a dress. I don't have all my friends here. I don't have my mother. You know, so it's all this, you know, so you can't really call it, it's very hard to call it engagement. What do we accomplish when we get engaged? Is there anything accomplished when we get engaged? So my Rebbe, Rabbi Baruch Simon, so he got engaged a little later in life. And the way that he described, he wouldn't use the word fiance to describe his wife. He called her his mishudeches. His mishudeches means a person who he already was matched up with, in the sense that they're not complete strangers. The Gemara tells us that Rav, and we'll hope maybe we'll get there together, hopefully, that Rav would give lashes to anyone who got married without a shidduch. A shidduch doesn't necessarily mean that they went to a matchmaker, but it means if people got married haphazardly without getting to know each other or getting to know the families or some level of taking it seriously, Rav would actually give lashes to the individual for not taking it seriously and making a proper decision. So what do we accomplish when we get engaged? When we get engaged, we're kind of making a declaration that now we know each other, that now we approve of each other, our families approve of each other, hopefully. And so we're past that. But halachically, if a couple breaks an engagement, there's nothing halachic to do. If after the stage of kiddushin, she needs a divorce. Even if in the times of old, if they only went through stage number one, and for whatever reason they decided to go their separate ways, she would need a divorce document, and she would no longer be able to marry a kohen. And it's pretty serious. And you know, the other obviously is the ramification. If a modern day couple like ourselves, obviously it shouldn't happen, but if she would have an affair with someone else after she's engaged, it might be not right and inappropriate, but it's not a capital offense. If after the first stage of marriage, again, it's obviously not a healthy relationship if she's having an affair, but if she would have an affair with someone, she would be obligated to receive the death penalty. So that's the first stage of marriage.
She dropped down on her knee and gave a ring in the park.
Right.
So saying we marry, we said, "Are we on Kadesh Ali?"
And there were two kosher witnesses there.
Yes, there was.
That was the first stage of marriage, and
Nesu'in.
No, you'd have to do the second stage of marriage in the appropriate time. That is the unfortunate circumstance that sometimes happens in high schools throughout America, or high school aged. You know, you got a kid learns a little bit of Kiddushin, thinks it's a joke, and in the schoolyard or in the Shabbos park, wherever, he takes out anything of value, and there are two guys next to him who keep Shabbos and don't gamble, and so they're kosher witnesses. And to a girl, he says this, and she accepts it. And, you know, you have rabbis sitting on the case, and it could be a very serious thing because she might actually be married, and then she needs a divorce, and she's 15 years old, and she can't marry a Kohen. So it's a big deal. And now, listen, there are many people who aren't, you know, we mentioned this last week, but it needs to be taken seriously.
Another more common scenario is you'll have two Jewish people who are not observant.
Right.
Right? And they will have a civil wedding.
Right. You mentioned this last week.
Well, that was a different one. But they have a civil wedding, and then all they have is a justice of the peace.
Right.
There's no kosher witnesses, right?
Right.
But they cohabitate. Halachically, their children and their marriage is they are still married, right?
So it's a little bit more complicated than answering it quickly. There's definitely nothing wrong, you know, if he's Jewish and she's Jewish, the children are Jewish, right. Of course.
But they are married, and theoretically, right. If they become Baal Tshuva, they would need a get.
Right. So there may be some poskim, there may be some halachic deciders who would say that when if they were, let's say, to become Baal Tshuva, that maybe they would get married again.
Yeah.
Again, not in a way to say that they hadn't been married, but maybe to do it in a proper way. They would probably need a little bit of, but again, then it gets a little sticky because then, you know, then it's making a declaration that the children were born out of wedlock, which, you know, even though they were, you don't want to necessarily advertise that. So again, if I'm sure it does come up, it definitely has to be dealt with in a sensitive way with a. You know, a prominent posik.
Wasn't the Gemara that went to a town like wants to marry me for a day? Some of the Gemara, I'm not sure if it was something like that.
There's some wacky case. We'll get to it.
No, it was like when I was like, well, it's one of the Amorim, yeah.
Right.
we're gonna mention it.
I think Rav or Rabbi, they would go to towns and they would have like a wife there.
Right.
When they traveled, so that like paid up or something. That when they
we have a while to get there.
Yeah. so that they would not have like a Yetzirah when they were out of town. They would like have a wife there and divorce them when they left.
Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So we have the. We got a. Yeah. Okay.
It's a good thing. Before the days of cell phones and internet, I suspect.
Right. Okay. So let's continue in the Mishnah on line number six. To see the ways out of marriage. We've been talking about the ways to enter marriage, but then it talks about, in the Mishnah, on line number six, V'kona es atzma. She can acquire herself to be independent, to be a free agent. Now she can marry someone else in two ways. Number one, beget, with a get. A get is the Jewish divorce document the husband extends to her. It's called a get. As the first Tosos in Maseches Gittin tells us, the word get is made out of a gimel and a tet. And Gimel is 3 and a Tet is 9. 3 plus 9 is 12. How many lines in a get? 12. 12 lines in a get. That's how the get got its name. Mm-hmm. So if the husband extends to her this document of divorce, then she is divorced. Ubemisa sabal. And the other option is for the husband to die. If the husband dies, she's no longer married and she's ready and able to marry someone else if she so chooses. Now it's important to point out that that's only if she and her husband, or if her husband already had children. If her husband had children, either with her or from a previous marriage, then his death will allow her to be a free agent. But as we'll see later, just later on in right, the next case in the Mishnah, if they didn't have any children, and the husband never had children from a previous marriage, then and he has surviving brothers, she's going to have to enter into what we call a levirate marriage with those brothers, or at least perform another option to have her be released before she can marry anybody else. So now I'm going to throw out two questions which are kind of wacky, but interesting nonetheless. I don't know if every shir I'll be able to have one of these, but this is I think it's worth it to come to this shir just for this question. So the question is, we just learned about that the two ways out of marriage for a Jewish person is death or a divorce. So this is a question that's dealt with by the commentators. What about Mrs. Eliyahu Hanavi? Eliyahu Hanavi was a prophet in the Book of Kings. It talks about him. He didn't die. The Pasuk mentions that he was raised up to heaven in a chariot of fire. And we know Eliyahu Hanavi, he comes to our brises, he comes to the Seder, he still, however we can explain it, he did not die a human death. And so the question is, although I've been through the Book of Kings, Kings 1 and Kings 2, we don't really hear about Mrs. Eliyahu Hanavi, but she existed. And so the question, and I don't know if after Eliyahu went up to heaven, if she wanted to get remarried, but, you know, in the Beis Medrash, I guess, you know, when you want to talk about something interesting, you come up with a question like this. Could Mrs. Eliyahu Hanavi marry? Her husband never died. He never extended her a divorce, and he never died. That's the question. And it's dealt with by serious people. Take a look at source number 2 on your sheet. Source number 2 is the Minchas Chinuch, Rabbi Yoel Babad, who wrote a running commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch. I believe our Mara Da'aser gives a shir on Sunday mornings in Minchas Chinuch. Is that right? Okay, it's on the schedule. I see it. Okay, so maybe everyone will go. So the Minchas Chinuch, Rabbi Yoel Babad, he writes like this in source number 2. V'gam nichali divrei baal trumas hadeshen. I agree with what the author of the Sefer of the book, Trumas Hadeshen, he was a Rishon, she kasvu de eishas Eliyahu. He wrote that the wife of Eliyahu, the eishas Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi is an Amora who's also always mentioned in the context of Eliyahu, and it could very well be that there were times that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi was able to go up to Shamayim with Eliyahu Navi. Muteres. The wives are mutter. The wives are permitted to go and marry someone. Why? The lo nikra eshes ish. Because she's no longer considered to be a married woman. Rak malach. Eliyahu Hanavi is not a person anymore. Eliyahu Hanavi became an angel. Ulachor nehi de lo tafsi kiddush mi malach. Granted, if a malach would come down and try to extend kedushin to a woman, it would not be effective. The lo nikra ish, because he's not a man. Mikol makom im hayaba kedushin gemurin. Now the Minchas Chinuch is asking a little bit of the question. He said, if you had real marriage, because he was a person, heich nifkain, how would the kedushin just expire, just explode? Halo lemisa saval tzrichin yalfusa bikedushin sheyatir. The Gemara had to go ahead and teach us a lesson that when the husband dies, she's allowed. It wasn't a self-evident that she could get married. The Gemara had to learn from Psukim that if the husband dies, she's allowed to get married to somebody else. So she had a real marriage. So he's wondering this. So then he answers very quickly. He says, "Ubazeh nicha kevan de ein tofsin kiddushin." Since you're going to say that if you had a malach standing here and he tried to extend the kiddushin, it wouldn't go. It would be like taking an American plug and plugging it into an Israeli outlet. It just doesn't go. Well, that might actually cause a fire of some sort. But it wouldn't fit. Imkein memela nifku akedushin ve'ein laharach. It is as if, therefore he thinks it's like when Eliyahu became like a malach, the kedushin that he originally had with his wife evaporated. Because he's no longer the man. So the answer to the question is she was allowed to get married. Whether she did or not, we don't know. But now,
is that a third way a woman can acquire herself?
There is no third way.
Well, it sounds like, because it doesn't sound like they're saying he died.
Oh, okay, so that's the third way, right? Third way. Right. So anyone who thinks
he didn't ever get.
So they get the Mishnah probably doesn't include it because it talks about the things that happen most of the time.
But okay, here's another question. There's a war, right? The husband goes off to war, and they lose the battle, right? This is a real situation, right?
Very sure.
Some are taken prisoner, some are dead, and we don't, you know, you don't know.
Right.
It's not like everything got a dog tagged, right?
Right.
So the woman says he could be a prisoner, he could be dead, or he could be missing.
Right.
How does she deal with that? I mean, one day.
Right. So, listen. In the times of David HaMelech, David would have his soldiers write divorce documents on condition and hand them out to the wives. and say, this is your divorce document. If I don't come back from war, it's effective as of the day that I left. And this way, it was, you know, it's a hard thing to do, but it's a very responsible thing to do.
But it could happen today when but it, people don't
so
prepare
the,
that way.
The, yeah, so in you have to, when cases like that happen, you go to the biggest rabbis, and the biggest rabbis deal with it. In the Yom Kippur War, there were many, many shilas that came out. Rav Avadya Yosef Zatzal, who was, you know, one of the leading halachic deciders of the last, you know, 50 years, spent hours and hours and weeks on these cases, and he was actually able, I believe he solved them all, and there were no agunos at the end. But it's something that, you know, you need the, you know, we just, this past Sunday, we commemorated 9/11. There were numerous cases, there were about 15 cases that had to be dealt with and had to be decided and had to be, you know, determined whether, you know, was the, that the husband died. And it's sometimes, and there are some situations, unfortunately, where if it can't be determined, then, you know, if, you know, these poskim, these Talmid HaChamim, they will, you know, turn over the ends of the earth to figure it out. But there may be some times where a woman is stuck, unfortunately. It is a reality. So the second question I want to throw your way does happen more often. And it's just interesting to think about because it's based off that comment of the Rambam of what marriage used to be. Is since the Gemara learns out that a Jewish woman, is allowed to marry if her husband dies, and they learn it out from Psukim, would that apply to a non-Jew? If a non-Jewish woman loses her husband, is she allowed to marry somebody else? So this is a question, source number 3. It's asked by the Pnei Yehoshua, one of the great Achronim, one of the great sages of the past couple of hundred years. The Pnei Yehoshua writes in source number 3, V'nira de lefize, afilu lefi amaskana, even according to the conclusion, to be Yisrael, that when you're dealing with a Jew, ikakra, there is a pasuk, the misas habal matir, that the death of the husband allows for his surviving wife to be permitted to marry someone else. Afilu hachi beben Noach, but if you're dealing with a ben Noach, if you're dealing with a Noahide, meaning the rest of the world who isn't Jewish, aser, seemingly the Pnei Yeshua thinks it might be prohibited for her to remarry. Me asei divadavik vidavak beishto, that talks about in the beginning of Bereishis, it says when a person gets married, the couple cleaves to each other, and maybe that's telling you that by non-Jews, that once they get married, they're married. And they can't, maybe death doesn't apply to a non-Jew. The death, obviously death applies, but that death doesn't allow her to remarry. That's the question of the Pnei Yehoshua. So what's the answer? So the answer, it really comes full circle to the Rambam. If before the Torah was given, I gave you the example tonight again, Harry meets Sally. So how do you affect a marriage? By two people coming together and say, we're married. So this is not to say that the divorce proceedings of non-Jewish people shouldn't be dealt with sensitively. But how, according to the Torah, how does a non-Jewish person get divorced? Well, look at the way they got married. If they got married by consenting to be together, then all they have to do to get divorced is consent to not be together. Move out. They move out. They stop their relationship. Relationship's over. If it's the same way there are a lot of learning that we do from the way a Jewish person gets divorced to the way a Jewish person gets married. So the same thing is true by a non-Jew. The same way they got married, they get divorced. Take a look at source number 4, the Rambam. This is the Rambam all the way at the end of Mishnah Torah. The Rambam describes some of the laws of non-Jews. And the Rambam says in Hilchos Malachim Perek Tes, Halacha Ches, when is the wife of his friend, this is for a non-Jew, when is his friend's wife like a divorcee in our world? When is she available? When will it not be adultery to go out with Mrs. McDonald? Whenever she leaves his house. Not whenever she leaves his house to go to the marketplace. Whenever she moves out, whenever that relationship is over, he sends her to be on her own, meaning if he decides that she shouldn't be part of the marriage. Let's, she decides to dump the guy. If she decides to leave her husband, Mrs. McDonald decides to leave Mr. McDonald, then it's fine. She'ein lohem girushin b'ktsav. They don't have a requirement of a divorce document. Obviously, United States court of law, you have to, you know, you have to deal with American law. That's something different. But in terms of how halacha would view it, they don't have to give a bill of divorce. The ein hadavar talui bo levad. Whenever they want to take a break, marriage can be over. This is, and it goes back to what the Rambam had said, that the same way they go into marriage, they can go out of the marriage. So with that logic in mind, if when both parties are alive, they're allowed to decide not to be together, and they are quote-unquote halachically divorced for a non-Jew, so if the guy dies, then there's no separation greater than this, than between this world and the next, and the world that comes after this world. So if the guy is dead, the marriage is over. It's based on them being together in their relationship, and if they're not together in a relationship, either because they moved out and decided to go their separate ways, or because the man died, she would be available.
Interesting.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So it could very well be that because we believe that the Jewish marriage has an element of sanctity to it, that it's evolved in a mitzvah, right? Non-Jews have seven mitzvahs. There are seven mitzvahs for Noahides. There are 613 for Jews. So somehow the stakes are a little higher and the requirements are different when there's the sanctity that's involved. Now, how you can explain it? It's probably hard, but it isn't. I did pick up that up as well, but it so that's interesting. But it is what it is. Now in America, so you actually do have to file for divorce. So American law would come into play because we follow a halacha called Dina de Malchusa Dina. The law of the land is the law. There are some real halachic Jews who won't cross when it says don't walk, because it's against the law. It's jaywalking is against the law, and the halacha is that the law of the land is the law, so you can't jaywalk. Same thing with the divorce, meaning you can't say that this law trumps the. We can't use that word anymore, right? You can't say that this rule in halacha takes precedent over American law, because we have another halakha that says you have to follow American law. So the Mr. and Mrs. McDonald, if they were living on halakha island, then they could follow what the Rambam is saying here. If they were living in Eretz Yisrael at a time that Eretz Yisrael only was ruled with halakha, then they would follow what the Rambam says. In America, they'd have to follow. They'd actually have to get a divorce, not a get, but a divorce. So let's finish the Mishnah. Which is always a good idea to do. And the Mishnah moves on to a separate topic, that after talking about how you affect marriage with a regular woman, it talks about the end of line 6, it talks about a Hayavama. Hayavama is the surviving widow whose husband died, and there are no children, and she has to marry the surviving brother. Hayavama niknes bebia. The Yavama, the sister-in-law, is acquired only through marital relations, says the Mishnah. She has to have marital relations with the brother-in-law, and once they have marital relations, she's totally his wife, as we'll see in Rashi in a second. V'kona es atzma, but if before they perform this levirate marriage, which we call yibum, she can acquire her own independence to go and marry other people in two ways. Number one, b'chalitza. They could perform the ceremony known as chalitza, and if they perform that ceremony as described in the Torah, I believe in this week's parsha, in Parshas Ki Tzetzeh, which involves in public saying that this surviving brother doesn't want to keep up his brother's name, and involves her spitting on the floor in front of him and throwing away his shoe, basically showing that he's not living up to his responsibilities. So if they do that, she can then go on from there and marry anyone that she wants, except the Kohen Gadol. She's a widow. A widow is allowed to marry a Kohen. She's a widow,
okay.
Because that's why she's doing Yibam. A widow is a divorcee, can't marry a Kohen.
She's a chalitza now.
Right. Oh, so if they go, through chalitza, you're right. The second option shall still be available. So if they go, if they go through chalitza, you're right. Sorry. If they go through chalitza, she won't be able to marry a Kohen, but she'll be able to marry anybody else. And the second option, she'll even be able to marry a Kohen, with Misa Sayavim, if, and this would be an unfortunate circumstance, if in the interim the surviving brother-in-law also died, so there's no one left to do the levirate marriage with her, unless he has other brothers, so then she would be available. So this we no longer perform Yibam. We don't perform levirate marriage. For at least 1,000 years, the Ashkenazi community has not performed Yibam. And in recent times, the Sephardic community also has come along. That basically we don't believe that the brother-in-law, the surviving brother-in-law, will have the right intentions when he performs this levirate marriage. And he might be doing it for the wrong intentions. Maybe his sister-in-law is very pretty, something of that along that nature. And so we mandate chalitza. And every case that comes up has to do chalitza. I think after 9/11, I believe there were actually 2 cases of chalitza. It's a very fascinating ceremony to be present at. My mother works for the Beis Din of America, the RCA's Beth Din, their Beis Din. And so when I think I was in college already, I went to a chalitza. You came? I didn't bring you.
Yeah.
Huh?
Let's do it then.
Oh, okay. There you go. So yeah, you know, there are certain times that chalitza can be very sensitive, and certain times that people don't mind, you know, some yeshiva guy is coming to watch it because it doesn't happen often. I believe there's the sofer of the RCA's Beis Din, Rabbi Lichter, his father, Rabbi Lichter Senior, has done I think even more than twenty chalitzas. He's basically he's one of the experts in New York on a chalitza, and it's definitely one of the more stranger,
Write something? Is there something to write?
There's nothing to write. There's a play. It's basically like they each get a script of what they have to say, and there's a special shoe. The shoe has to be made out of kosher leather. The shoe kind of looks like an ancient sandal with tefillin straps are used, and there are a few shoes. I don't know if there are more than 10 chalitza shoes in the country. My mother actually once found one in the filing cabinets of the Beth Din on a different floor. In the middle of the filing cabinet, she found an old thing, and they dusted it off, and it was actually a chalitza shoe. And so it's in this week's parsha. So take a look. So Ez Hashem, there's actually a fascinating Rashi on this idea of the Yavama, and Bez Hashem, next time we will start with that Rashi.